battle's been lost, the war is not won. An addled republic, a bitter refund. The business first, flat earthers licking their wounds. The verdict is dire, the country's in ruins. Providence bleeds, facing the sun.
Then with all the talk about global warming, we tightened our belts and we showed the world what we could do. And between 2000 and 2006, we tripled it. And now emissions are growing at over 3% a year. So we are headed on a runaway train right now to do the biggest experiment with our planet that humans have ever done. And we are just going to see what happens unless we dramatically change course, starting basically now.
So we've written our stories to entertain. These notions of glory and bull market gain. The teleprompter flutters, the power surge screams.
That was California scientist Nate Lewis, Telling It Like It Is, accompanied by the band R.E.M. from their new album, Accelerate. There is a line there in that song, Providence sleeps, facing the sun. In this Radio EcoShock special, we are going to explain how solar energy could save us from climate change, from dependence on foreign oil, and from declining oil and gas reserves, peak oil. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We will hear that extraordinary interview with Nate Lewis via the top Australian science show on ABC National. Nate explains in just a few minutes why humans will develop solar power or fail utterly. In the second half of the show, we have our most important interview, a world roundup of solar tech in the labs and in the utility industry. It's by our Wall Street Insider expert who runs the Climateer Investing blogspot. This is the solutions section, the real light at the end of the energy and climate tunnel. If we can harness the sun's amazing power in time. Don't miss that interview with the Climateer. You're going to need some good news just to keep going from what I'm about to tell you next. And that is because we humans may just be bobbleheads on our way to extinction.
Condition red.
May God have pity on them.
Exhibit 1, YouTube videos popped up all over the net last week showing a freak April snowstorm in the UK. The obvious conclusion? There is no global warming. It is all a hoax. My take? The denial cult has spread from the well-paid oil men to a few young punks looking for teen rebellion. Part of growing up is tossing out what your parents say. They struggle to create an identity in a world that sells it by the bucketful, by making homemade anti-climate change videos. See, I don't go with the crowd. I deny all science, even reality. All the evidence I need is a snowstorm in April. Write on the blackboard 100 times, weather is very fickle. It is what happens this week. Climate is steadily changing. It is what happens this decade or even this century. Now, Exhibit 2, pirates are taking advantage of the so-called Clean Development Mechanism, the CDM, developed by the Kyoto Protocol. The idea seems simple. A polluting coal plant in Germany would pay for new solar equipment in China, perhaps, instead of cutting back in Germany. What is the difference? As long as the pollution goes down globally, and developing countries get help installing less polluting energy. The problem is, there really are no rules and definitely no police. So bandits make billions while the planet gets nothing but more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. In early February, Bloomberg reported, quote, the carbon traders and the UN's CDM overseers are playing the European ratepayers for chumps. In a nutshell, some Chinese factories were being built specifically to take a highly dangerous greenhouse gas, the HFCs, involved in refrigeration. Then they charged $6.2 billion to install capture equipment that cost only $100 million. Eco-conscious Europeans paid extra on their utility bills to fund this scam in China, all approved by the United Nations Clean Development Mechanism. The UN now says this loophole has been closed. It would be a sad joke, but folks, we don't have time to fool around paying off the sharks instead of installing clean alternative energy. It gets worse, much worse. The same UN/Kyoto Clean Development Mechanism is now approving financing for a super monster coal plant complex in India. And the billions to build it will come from the World Bank through its International Finance Corporation, the IFC. Top it all off with the label of clean coal, and there you go, mega coal to save the planet. It is called, appropriately enough, the Tata Ultra Mega. At the port city of Mundra, in the state of Gujarat in India, a project sponsored by Tata Power Company will build 5 coal-powered plants, 800 megawatts each. That's 4,000 megawatts of steaming coal-burning love for the planet. It is one of the early public-private power projects for western and northern India, as the government itself admits it can't keep up with the demand for electrification of the country. According to the IFC, quote, India is currently facing enormous demand-supply gap of about 11% energy shortage and 14% peak power shortage. Well, you know what that means. A lot of people can't get their electricity, they can't get businesses going, they can't even get lights to their housing. Well, it costs about $4 billion for the Tata Ultra Mega, and it's designed to pollute for 25 years. By that time, the Arctic ice cover will be gone forever. The plan is called Clean because it uses a technology called supercritical to burn the coal. Boys and girls, we need to learn this coal talk because it may shape the world of future human generations. Supercritical is a technical term. Anybody who boils a kettle knows that when water reaches a certain temperature, it changes state from liquid to steam. We could drive a turbine with that steam to make electricity. But what if we put the water under a lot of pressure so it can't just become steam easily, and then we keep pouring on the heat? Water reaches a new state which isn't really liquid and it isn't steam either. If you can just keep it from blowing up, that supercritical mixture of steam or water can really make electric turbines whirl. As a result, supercritical coal plants can generate more electricity using less coal. The IFC claims the Tata Ultra Mega will be 70% more efficient than old Indian coal-fired plants and even 20% more efficient than most coal-burning generators in Western countries. So, the amount of greenhouse gas will be less per unit of energy generated. But when you build 5 giant coal plants at a time, the actual boost to greenhouse gases to the atmosphere will be huge. David Wheeler, a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, says the Tata Ultra Mega is a huge mistake, and the IFC should not fund it. Wheeler writes, quote, "This plant will emit 25.7 million tons of CO2 every year for at least 25 years, adding another 643 million tons to an atmospheric carbon load that is already driving us toward an environmental catastrophe," end quote. Wheeler has written a paper showing how, quote, "the region near Mundra has huge solar potential and is one of the most sparsely settled areas in India. Baseload solar power with thermal storage for 24-hour operation is now technically feasible," end quote. He concludes, in short, IFC's proposed Tata Ultra Mega project is obsolete, unnecessary, ultra dangerous for the planet, and mega dangerous for the environmental reputations of the IFC and the World Bank Group. Does anyone really believe that donor country taxpayers will continue supporting the World Bank Group if it takes billions for the Clean Technology Fund with one hand and invests billions in coal-fired monsters with the other? Let's get serious here. The IFC's board should take Ban Ki-moon's Bali Declaration of a Planetary Emergency seriously. Vote no on the Tata Ultra Mega. So writes David Wheeler. Find his blog at karma.org. One blog comment replies that Americans should stop lecturing Indians about how to solve widespread poverty there and campaign to power down the Las Vegas Strip instead, which, quote, uses the same power in a day as two Indian towns of 2.5 million people each. Let's talk about your Best Buys running huge LCDs, average energy intensity twice that of a regular TV, all day, before you talk about India going solar while the U.S. puts up 73 new coal plants from 2008 to 2012. Sitting in Washington, try and clean up your own country before you come and try and take away our time and place in destiny. End quote from an Indian writer. Meanwhile, at grist.org, you can find one of the few articles about this coal disaster titled Tata Mega, the World's Dumbest Project. I always wonder, who are the actual people behind such planet-killing projects? Who could just say no? In the case of Tata, there are curtains behind curtains when it comes to control and ownership of the Tata Group, India's largest industrial conglomerate. Long story short, Tata was built by the Tata family over the past 100 years and is now run by the latest son, Ratan Tata. But he doesn't actually own more than 1% of the company. The Tatas are part of a tiny minority of India called the Parsi. Originally from Iran, the Parsi migrated to northern India at least 1,000 years ago. They retained their separate identity by forbidding intermarriage. The Parsi families are renowned for trading and industry and for their fabulous charity. And yet their culture discourages individual wealth. So earlier Tata patriarchs donated much of the company's stock to Parsi charitable trusts. Good luck finding out who controls those. But there is one big stockholder in Tata. You have never heard of the Mistry family, and that is spelled M-I-S-T-R-Y, and they are a mystery. This wealthy Parsi family are phenomenal in their ability to avoid any kind of media exposure. So let us welcome to Radio EcoShock Mr. Palonji Mistry, the current patriarch thought to control a personal wealth over $6 billion. Although he is a person of Mumbai, Palonji Mistry recently became an Irish citizen. He is now the richest Irishman in the world. Palonji Mistry owns somewhere around 18% of Tata Sons, a top-tier company of the Tata Group. Palonji has enough control to steer Tata away from their climate-killing People's Car that was recently announced. It will stink up India's highways and help pollute the world. And certainly from the disastrous Tata Mega Ultra. When the monsoons that feed India fail to come year after year, when Bangladesh and parts of northeast India sink below the rising seas, when the breadbasket of the Punjab is wiped out by heat and storms like Australia, will the people of India look back in thanks to the Tata and Mistry families, the ones who steered India into the black hole of coal? There is still time to bring pressure on the World Bank and the IFC to stop financing coal mega projects like the Tata Ultra Mega as solutions to climate change. Stop lying. Mother Nature punishes liars. Now, how much we need some good news. Well, it is coming in solar. Japanese electronics giant Sharp has announced it will build a $729 million solar cell plant in the city of Sakai. It will be the world's largest solar cell plant to open in March of 2010. Yes. Southern California Edison Company has announced a budget of $875 million to build the largest solar installation in America. The solar cells, which cover 2 square miles of rooftops, could power 162,000 homes. The solar cells will be mounted on commercial rooftops, the beginning of the solar city. In addition, Associated Press reports a Florida-based company, FPL Energy, has another project. Quote, the company's proposed Beacon Solar Energy project would involve more than 500,000 parabolic mirrors assembled in rows on 2,000 acres in the Mojave Desert, north of Los Angeles, end quote. That would produce 250 megawatts of power. Take that, Tata Ultra. We have lots more solar news, good and bad, to come in our feature interview this week as we get the inside scoop from the climateer. But first, I want you to hear why only solar can really save us. I've told you before about a great science program coming out of Australia. It's called The Science Show and hosted expertly by Robin Williams. You can get The Science Show by podcast, and this clip tells you how. You are going to hear a powerful exchange between one Nathan Lewis, a California professor and solar whiz, and Robin Williams, About 2 years ago, I posted a lecture by Nate Lewis about how to power the whole Earth from solar energy. It is still on our site. Now we can find out that Nate isn't happy that big countries and big companies are not listening. He gives them and all of us an earful in this new barrage of powerful logic about our deteriorating atmosphere and what needs to really happen. Here is Nate Lewis on the ABC National Radio Program.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and today something of a follow-up. How are some sceptical and responsible scientists adjusting their opinions about climate change and energy use as the evidence mounts up in journals? Are they becoming more forthright or even desperate, or are they calmly maintaining a prudent wait-and-see attitude? Well, of course, it depends on the scientist, but we'll hear from three of them today, starting with Nate Lewis, a professor of chemistry at Caltech, who is one of the authors of a policy document for America. This is Professor Lewis in 2006.
What we know, absolutely, is we know from the records of the geological ice core data that the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide over the past 670,000 years has never been above 300 parts per million. And we know that at the current rate that we're consuming fossil energy, that it will be at double that level or more within the next 40 years. We also know that there's no way to get rid of it, and so it will last for 1,000 years at that level until it naturally dissolves in the oceans.
Personally, what do you think? How are we going to make it?
I think there's doubt that the Earth would be identical or similar to the one we live in now at those levels of CO2. There's no way to know absolutely that it won't be okay, but a lot of the models, even if there's only a 10% chance that they're right, we only get one shot at this, and if we're wrong and the models are right, then the Earth really isn't a similar place to the one we live on now. So it really depends on how lucky we feel. I'm not going to take a stand on how lucky I feel. I'm not going to, being a 50-year-old person, maybe see the effects of that that'll kick in. You see, the Earth has a 35-year thermal inertia. And so what we're doing now is only the beginning, because we're waiting 35 years even to see the effects of what we did 35 years ago.
Nate Lewis in 2006. Worried, slightly equivocal, concerned, of course. But what does he say about climate and energy use 2 years later? Rather more exasperated, perhaps?
Well, the energy options for the world haven't changed, but our carbon emissions have. In fact, with all the talk about Kyoto, it's interesting to look at what we've done. Between 1990 and 1999, CO2 emissions globally rose at an annual rate of 1.1% per year. Then, with all the talk about global warming, we tightened our belts and we showed the world what we could do. And between 2000 and 2006, we tripled it. And now emissions are growing at over 3% a year. So we are headed on a runaway train right now to do the biggest experiment with our planet that humans have ever done, and we are just going to see what happens unless we dramatically change course starting basically now.
Dramatically? So you're suggesting if it's a runaway, we can't do much about it?
We can, in principle, still hold the concentrations of carbon dioxide to something like 450 parts per million. But it's not enough to hold the rate of increase constant, because that just means you're continuing to adding debt to your credit card. We have to try to pay off our big balance, and we would have to cut emissions by something like 80% within the next 40 years in order to not be adding more CO2 to the atmosphere above some level that it won't go back down for millennia. So we only really have two choices. Decide that we're willing to take a risk with the only planet that we have, or decide that we can meet this challenge, and we have an option not to fail as the choice that's in front of us.
Well, one of the problems with meeting that challenge is, just to add another figure to your statistics, you've got 90 million people a year being added to the burden, and you've got, in the next couple of decades, something like another billion who are going to put the figures up all the while, and at the same time you're supposed to be reducing despite that extra burden.
That's right. That's exactly the challenge. Most projections say that energy demand will double in 30 years and triple in 40 and 50 years because of population growth and economic growth, both in the developed and in the developing countries. If we held it constant, energy demand, that is, which the world has never done in human history, because CO2 emissions are cumulative, all that would do would be put off the date at which they would double from their pre-anthropogenic levels, from 2050 to 2065 or so. So it really doesn't help much in the big picture. You have to meet doubling of demand by basically saving as much energy as all the energy we now use on our planet combined, and making as much clean energy within our lifetimes as all the energy we used on our planet combined today, so that the arithmetic can work out. That's the challenge. We could do it if we chose to. We have technologies on the shelf. We have existing and incubating technologies. We just have to decide whether or not we're willing to roll the dice or we're willing to meet the challenge. And we get to decide that exactly once.
California is being held up as a great example of what could be done. How do you think you're doing as part of the front line of meeting the challenge?
California certainly has, from an overall portfolio viewpoint, one of the most aggressive clean energy strategies of any state, and arguably of almost any country, if you consider California a 10th or 11th biggest economy in the world. Over the last 20 years, energy consumption per capita in the United States has risen by 30%, but energy consumption per capita in California is flat. The reason for that is that we've enacted as a state good building codes, double pane windows, energy efficient vehicles, compact fluorescent light bulbs. So we know that if the rest of the United States just did tomorrow what California has done today, that we could save 30 or 40% of our energy right here, right now. You have to understand that CO2 doesn't just heat the earth. CO2, as anybody knows who's ever drunk a Coca-Cola or a soda, is an acid. When you add CO2 to water, it makes it acidic. Australians, I think, should be especially concerned because 20% of the coral is already bleached globally, and many, but not all, climate models predict that due to our acidification of the oceans, between half and all the coral will be bleached within our lifetimes. That means that your wonderful and highly economically profitable tourist economy based on the Great Barrier Reef and its wonderful coral may or may not ever be there to be seen again by any human on our planet. We simply have to decide if we're going to take the chance that that will go away or stop it now.
There are still some people, Professor Lewis, who say that the CO2 effect is not proven to be linked to human activity. Are you, as someone who involved in chemistry, sympathetic to that line of argument?
Let's separate what we know from what we don't know. We absolutely know that human activity from burning fossil fuels produces CO2 that goes into the air. When you get into your car and your gas tank is filled at the beginning and it's empty at the end, where do you think all that carbon dioxide went? It went into the air. You don't need to be a brain surgeon to understand that burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide. In addition, we know exactly how much fossil fuels we've burnt as a society every year. We know how much carbon dioxide goes into the air. And you know what? That's exactly how much we measure appears in the air before half of it partitions in the oceans and into the plants, which we understand. We've also isotopically labeled that carbon, so we know from its mix that the nail is in the coffin, that human fossil fuel consumption is the main, most dominant and almost exclusive cement production makes some CO2 also. But almost all of that CO2 rise is uniquely ascribable to human fossil fuel consumption. There is no question about that from the basic laws of chemistry. There is a question as to whether or not that rise in CO2, which beyond any shadow of a doubt is due to humans, is going to be dangerous and lead to climate change. We do know that for the last 670,000 straight years, that as temperatures have gone up and down, so have CO2 levels. We don't absolutely know what would happen when we doubled it, because the Earth has never been there before in modern human history. We are betting against 750,000 years of data and hoping that this time we get lucky.
My final question, given the options that you say are available of the new technology to provide energy, which are the two or three that you think really now seem to be the most likely?
If your concern is energy security, you will go to coal and potentially some nuclear. And in fact, the only three big cards we have to play are clean coal, nuclear power, and that enormous fusion reactor that nature gave us 93 million miles away, which is the sun. If we cleaned up coal, we need to prove it works. Because since CO2 lasts so long, it lasts for thousands of years in our atmosphere, you have to bury it for thousands of years. If it's buried for 100 years and 1% of it leaks, then after 100 years of burial, the amount that's emitted will be identical to what you mitigated in the first place. We need to show that every site in the world, the global average leak rate for 1,000 years is on average less than 0.1% per year. We have no scientific data to show that that does or does not yet happen, and that's what we should be striving for. Secondly, we could build nuclear power plants. If you want to hold CO2 to double, we would have to build a new nuclear power plant every day somewhere in the world for the next 38 straight years. And since they only last for 40 years, we would have to build a new nuclear power plant starting today somewhere forever. In addition, after 10 years, even all of Australia's uranium, in fact, all of the world's uranium, is insufficient, so we would have to start building them today out of plutonium. Tens of thousands of plutonium-containing nuclear reactors is a different world than the one that we live in, or probably the ones our children would like to live in if they made it there with tens of thousands of nuclear reactors. The only other option is the sun, because more energy from the sun hits the Earth in 1 hour than all the energy consumed on our planet in an entire year. No other resource is close. More energy from the sun in a year hits our Earth than all the energy consumed by humans in history, combined from all sources together. Australia has a tremendous solar resource. Every country has enough. We just simply have to find a way to capture, convert, and store sunlight, because if we just put solar cells up, we'll get energy at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a bright, sunny day. But what do you do at night? What do you do in the winter? You have to find a way to store it. Plants do that. but not very efficiently. And so you need large areas. And so we need to come up with a technological way to harness the biggest resource that nature gave us, which is the sun.
Nate Lewis, who's Professor of Chemistry at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. I'm Robin Williams, and my thanks to Kyla Slaven for help with this program.
This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. We've just heard why we need solar, but what is the business world doing about it? To find out, we are joined now by our Wall Street Insider expert, the proprietor of the Climateer Investing Blogspot. Listen up. This man is plugged into the places where hundreds of millions of dollars trade in alternative energy.
I want to see you in the sun. I want to see you in the sun. I want to see you in the sun.
Where is solar energy today? We are joined again by our Wall Street Insider correspondent, the proprietor of Climateer Investing blog. Well, welcome, and thanks for giving us some of your valuable time.
Alex, what a great time to be alive.
You bet.
I really mean that. When we left last time, you said, well, on that optimistic note, you're absolutely right.
Well, let's start out. I want to ask, is solar energy still a development project, or is it becoming a real industry?
As to size, it's still very tiny, and we'll get to that. First off, though, for your older listeners, I want to make a point. I know you asked me not to go into a lot of history, but what we're going to talk about today is not what I think of as hippie solar. When I was a kid, the idea seemed to be that everyone would live in a geodesic dome and have a solar panel to run their power amplifier, and they'd have a light bulb so they could read the whole Earth catalog. And thank goodness that's all they did. They had very simple lives because those solar panels in 1975 cost $100 a watt. It's down to $2 a watt and dropping right now. I mean, that's an incredible drop, 50-fold over the last 33 years. So it's not what a lot of older folks, myself included, would think of as solar. This is beyond the cutting edge. And we can take a moment here to go back to your original question, the develop versus developing. One quick example of where the industry is right now. CleanEdge put out a report 3 or 4 weeks ago. The entire solar industry worldwide did about $20 billion in revenues in 2007. One company in Canada, did a bit over $21 billion. So they're smaller than Canada's largest energy company, much less an ExxonMobil or a Chevron. It's still very, very tiny. But, and this is the important thing, when I first came into business, there was a story going around about a couple of shoe salesmen back in the 50s. They're sent off to Africa and told, sell. They get to Africa, one shoe salesman wires back, lousy market, nobody wears shoes here. The other shoe salesman says, great market, nobody wears shoes here. And it really is all on how you look at it. Coming from a $20 billion base, the upside is so big, that's the reason that the big venture capitalists, the big investment banks, are plowing really big money into this. The CleanEdge, again, in their report from earlier this month, said they expect 3.5 to 4-fold growth. They expect about a $70 billion industry 10 years out. That might end up being on the low side. Things are happening so fast, Alex, that, well, if you had any specific questions, why don't you just jump on in, because I could go on with this stuff for hours.
Well, I'm quite willing to let you go on for hours because I think you know what you're talking about. But let's just start with this one. As you know, Southern California Edison just announced plans to build the country's biggest solar installation. It's going to cost $875 million. That should give the American market a bit of a sign or a lift or a signal, don't you think?
Oh my goodness, that one project is so large in scope, just the thinking behind it. It's what we call utility scale solar. And again, it is not the little panels on the roof. This is meant to be competitive on a cost basis with coal-fired electricity. And that is the holy grail. We'll get into some of the subsidies and whatever that have made solar grow as fast as it has. But the real goal of all of this, and the SoCal Edison, as you say, just shy of $1 billion investment, that's a big bet. The fellows at Google, especially Sergey Brin, are backing a company called NanoSolar. Their goal is to get electricity out of nanosolar cells cheaper than coal-fired. They announced earlier this year, or maybe it was late December, they had achieved 99 cents per watt, cell cost, which means usually you double the cost of the cell. So let's say $1 a watt, you double that to get your installed cost of $2. This goes back to something we talked about the first time I called in. The last coal-fired power plant that I looked at was going to cost approximately $2 billion to generate 1,000 megawatts, or $2 a watt for their fixed cost. Well, it appears that NanoSolar has already achieved that goal of being competitive on a cost basis, and with that, the sky really is the limit. There are so many approaches going on right now, and maybe this would be a good time to just give a quick overview of the different types. Is that okay?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, right now in solar panels, the two main types are silicon-based, which is the stuff that has created the entire semiconductor world we live in, and what's called thin film. The advantages of silicon, A, it's an established technology. The fabricators that actually make wafers of silicon know how to do this, and they are very good at getting the purity you need. What you're trying to do is take those photons from the sun, excite the electrons in whatever material you're using as your semiconductor, so that the electrons step up in energy phase and then create an electrical current. The doing it with semiconductor material is very straightforward. It's been a problem for the last 2 years because the growth has been so fast, there have been acute shortages of silicon. That's ending right now. This month and next month, we'll start to see new supplies come online. But it has driven the cost of silicon through the roof, so that when it was already a more expensive process or approach, it really got expensive. The other major type is what's called thin film, where you're applying a film which is going to be the semiconductor to some sort of substrate or backing. Right now, the leader in that area is a company called First Solar out of Phoenix. First Solar uses a combination of cadmium and tellurium. This NanoSolar that I had mentioned earlier uses a tongue twister. I'll just call it SIGS because it's a copper, indium, gallium, selenide. And I don't want to have to keep saying that. Okay, with SIGS, this compound of metals and chemicals, it is inefficient on a comparison basis with the silicon, except just last Monday, and Alex, this is how fast the industry is moving. Just last Monday, the Department of Energy here in the U.S., their National Renewable Energy Lab, the NREL, which has been a major key player in all of the development, announced they had achieved 19.9% conversion efficiency. The average conversion efficiency of silicon right now is about 20.3%, so they're within half a percentage point of matching silicon's efficiency with a lot cheaper manufacturing technique. This is where it breaks wide open. With the two types, even with the shortage of silicon being solved in the new supply coming on, it looks like a thin film is going to rule for the next few years at minimum.
It almost sounds like a Blu-ray versus HD war, where one comes out on top, or will both be used extensively?
Nope. One will come out on top, and it'll be a function of cost and price. And in this case, I think it'll be the Blu-ray. I think it'll be the thin film. The reason for that, and this is, I don't mean to get all philosophical, but there's enough money to do anything, but there's not enough money to do everything. So as we go forward in solar, we have to choose a standard to go with. Now, there is a third type, and this refers to these large utility-scale installations called concentrated or concentrating solar, where rather than making the electricity directly by exciting electrons, they heat a salt brine to, I think it's over 700 degrees, and use that heat energy to then power a standard turbine. That is going to be a very competitive technology. It's just being scaled up right now. But for the foreseeable 3 to 5 years, it'll be panels made with thin film, I believe.
Well, who are some of the big solar players, and what have you heard about large installations overseas?
Okay, right now, the largest manufacturer is Sharp Electronics, using their expertise in semiconductors. In 2006, they produced 25% of all the solar cells in the world. The second large player is a company in Germany called Q-Cells. They did, I believe it was on the order of 250 megawatts to Sharp's 400 and something, I think 430 or 440. Then you have a Chinese company, Suntech, another Japanese company, Kyocera, and Sanyo. So because they were using the silicon, the major players were the electronics manufacturers. That's changing right now. As I said, First Solar is coming on. They had the most dramatic price appreciation that you can imagine. They came public at $20 a share. Within 13 months, the stock was at $283, better than ninefold in just over a year. It was madness. It was a bubble. And the stock subsequently dropped off into the 160s. It's now back up, though, into the 230 range. It just had a recent run-up. So the thin film is recognized as being competitive. But First Solar's problem is with their cadmium telluride approach, they don't have the efficiency. They have the low cost, but they don't have the efficiency. Companies like this NanoSolar out of California, which, by the way, is backed by the Google guys. I mean, very smart technology people seem to be gravitating to this. The venture capitalists, the ones that basically built Yahoo, Kleiner Perkins, are in this. That's also the firm that Al Gore recently joined, that are in this up to their eyeball. So it's a very high-tech approach, which is why I let off saying it's not hippie solar at all anymore.
Well, even some big oil companies who have billions to invest are buying solar companies, and they use that in their advertising, but it seems their actual solar production is pretty tiny. Do you think they could be sincere about getting into this new energy?
Well, it's intriguing in that British Petroleum, BP, has been in solar since 1973. They were one of the largest, but when Lord Brown was asked to leave as CEO, the new CEO decided that they were going back to their carbon roots. The Shell was also a major player, but they sold their solar. I mean, by major, they were in the top 10. They sold their solar business. So I think it's as much PR and branding, and I won't go so far as to say greenwashing, because they actually did produce product. But I don't see them going forward because, A, they don't have the technological expertise that Silicon Valley and Tokyo and now Beijing can draw on. It is a whole new world out there. You, in our after recording discussion last time, asked me if I was afraid about something coming out of some lab that I had never heard of and just changing the ball game. That was as an astute question as any non-investor I've ever heard from. The reason is, here's just one example. There's a company called Kanarka that is developing a thin film that you can actually apply with an inkjet printer. I mean, if you can do that, it skips right past NanoSolar, which uses big reel-to-reel printers to lay down their ultra-cheap stuff. There's a technology called, goodness, let me make sure I get this right, quantum dots, whereby applying a nano-manufactured nano-composite to the thin film, you extend the range of the spectrum that the light will absorb. With a quantum dot, you can actually generate electricity from infrared, which means you could theoretically create electricity in the dark. And this is the kind of thing that really does scare me as an investor in some of the what are now cutting-edge technologies, but that could be eclipsed by some fella in a small lab somewhere. It's that dynamic.
I appreciate that. And meanwhile, I want to ask you one big question. You know, we're told that the market system will take care of climate change somehow, but I wonder, is there a problem in the necessary medium of capital investment in solar? Are people too nervous to get in, or do you think it's getting the investment it needs?
Well, no, it's not getting the investment it needs. And one of the problems is the venture capital mindset it's just too short-term. And the reason for it is, I mean, yeah, you can fund a genius software developer and have a product out on the street in 18 months and be generating revenues. But with the energy stuff, you've got to be looking for longer-term paybacks and be aware of that as you go into it. So the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road want to be there because they know that the payoffs will be huge, but they don't want to commit to 5, 10, 15, 20-year payoff periods, which is what you're looking at in energy. Even in oil and natural gas, from the time you discover the field to the time that you're actually producing can be 10, 12 years, much less when you're creating brand-new technologies. And then going through the process of commercializing them, going through the learning curve to bring down production costs, getting the stuff out there and actually generating revenues. So that there is a real problem. I mentioned the National Renewable Energy Lab from the Department of Energy. They have been critical in the development of, well, they work with First Solar on their cadmium telluride. If it hadn't been for the NREL, that would never have come to be. It's going to have to be a public-private partnership. And here's where I differ from some of my capitalist friends. I think the public purse should either A, get a piece of the rewards down the road, and I mean just in the form of societal benefits. I mean cash money. Or B, rather than subsidies, and I do want to get to those shortly, There should be grand prizes. I have this picture of what a $500 million prize would do to stimulate research in the private sector. And it'd be a one-time payoff, and that'd be it. There'd be no subsidies going forward. Here's where I have a problem with subsidies. As an investor, you are so dependent on the politician's whim. If they think the wind is blowing against subsidies, they're gone. And then you run into the same situation the U.S. has had since 1980, where you start ramp development, the subsidies go, and your legs are cut out from under you. It's happening right now in the U.S., although Pelosi says she's going to bring up the subsidies for a vote on Earth Day coming up here in April. It's fine and dandy to have government approach it from the subsidy angle, but as an investor, I'd much prefer some sort of incentive just to get the cost below that of coal-fired electricity, in which case you won the game right there. Does that make sense to you?
It does indeed, and I also appreciate your idea of the public-private partnership where the public gets some reward for government money invested when this does pay off.
I tell you, that does not fly on Wall Street, but it really can work. That there is no reason that the federal treasuries cannot participate. When the U.S. bailed out Chrysler, they got warrants to purchase stock. If the company succeeded, it did survive. The treasury was more than amply compensated for the risk that they took on guaranteeing the debt. So it's not unprecedented. Going forward here, back to the subsidies, I want to approach this real quickly. One example of how politicians change their mind. Germany, for the last 2 years, has been the fastest growing market for solar. And that was because they had very substantial, what they call feed-in tariffs, where once the stuff is on your roof, you can sell electricity back to the grid. Well, late last year, they decided they were going to shift the subsidies from solar to wind. And that meant that all the solar infrastructure that had been built dependent on subsidies, and it's that dependency thing as much as anything that's the problem, well, was all of a sudden left high and dry. And now wind is going to be developed. The Germans are doing this for strategic reasons. They don't want to be dependent on Russian natural gas and coal. So that they do have a reason for doing this, but it's a real problem as an investor. It's called rent seeking. When you're in a rent seeking business, you better be aware of it, because if you're dependent on the politicians and you aren't keeping your finger to the wind as to what the prevailing view is, you really can lose a lot of money. Right now, Ontario has the highest feed-in tariff in the world. I believe it's 42 cents a kilowatt, and that is driving the industry in Ontario. But if that were to drop off, solar doesn't make a lot of sense when there's snow on the solar panel. And they might actually decide, well, maybe we should go with wind too. An example of subsidy has gone crazy is Oregon, where there are enough different programs where if you game the system just right, you can put the panels on your roof and walk away with cash in hand. I think that's nuts, but there should be some skin in the game from the person who's putting the panels on the roof, much less getting cash out of the deal on top of it. But it's just a philosophical thing going forward that the whole goal is to get the cost below the price of coal-fired electricity. However we get there, we get there. It's debatable going forward. One other point I want to make, I don't know the fellow, but a man named Tom Conrad at Alt Energy Stock, it's another blog, had a very thoughtful piece earlier this month on whether subsidies are a wealth transfer from the poor to the rich. And he came down, after really laying out the arguments on both sides, that yes, the poor, because they can't afford solar panels, they can't afford the upfront cost, but they do pay to subsidize those who can. It is a wealth transfer, but the societal good is big enough. I have one example that I think is obscene. General Electric, largest company in the world, makes solar cells. The state of Connecticut has a program that if you install solar on your roof, they will give you a grant to help subsidize it. General Electric applied for that grant and received it to install General Electric solar cells on General Electric headquarters. Now, on its face, that's ridiculous, but it's even worse. The city of Bridgeport's one of the poorest cities in the United States. In fact, I think it's the poorest of its size in the country. Every ratepayer in Bridgeport had to help support General Electric's putting their own solar cells on their roof. And it's stuff like that that it just drives me nuts. If there's a way to cut that kind of big business gaming of the system, I want to know about it, and I want to try to have a voice going forward here.
Well, despite these problems, as we wrap up, what is your gut feeling? Do you think solar will one day be the primary energy source for civilization?
Yeah. You know, Alex, just again, this stuff is so recent. 2 days ago, an MIT professor said it's the only way when you really look at it. If I was a lot younger and going to school right now, the three things I would do is, A, I would learn Mandarin, because you're going to have to know Chinese if you're going to deal on the world stage. B, I would get as broad an education as I could, because as we learn in Ecology 101, everything is connected. The more data points you have, the more connections you can make. And three, I would keep up with my math skills, because if you're willing to do what other people aren't willing to do, you'll be allowed to live like no one else can live. It really is a heck of an opportunity. People are only at their best when the challenges are big, and this is a big challenge, and it's going to bring out the best in a lot of people.
Well, once again, thank you for giving away your valuable insight, and listeners can get more of that every day from climateerinvest.blogspot.com. I'll let you go, but I hope we can talk again.
Alex, there's so much more to this. I look forward to the opportunity.
All right. This is Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. We'll go out with the Dan Bergson song, Power From Above, which I'd like to dedicate to all the hippies out there with solar panels who will at least have, well, some music and a little bit of light if the big system goes out from time to time.
Sinners, are you ready for a little redemption, to receive forgiveness for what we've done? The time has come to break bad habits. It's time to turn to the wind and sun. It may take strength to say no to that power from below, but there's salvation in the power from above. Yes, there's salvation in the power from above.
You've been listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Find our website at ecoshock.org and tune in next week for our special on oil addiction. We all need to get around.
Addicted to oil.
Might as well face it, you're addicted
to oil.
Do you find yourself paying and paying for oil, sticking the needle in your tank? You need the stuff. You're addicted. Coming up on Radio EcoShock, the intervention for oil addicts. Special guest to find out why we're hooked. The Oil Addict Special, only on Radio EcoShock. We'll go out the way we started, with a hot new song from the album Accelerate by R.E.M. The tune is Until the Day is Done, and it has the line I love, the line to live by, Providence sleeps facing the sun.
The battle's been lost, the war is not won. An addled republic, a bitter refund. The business first, flat earth is licking their wounds. The verdict is dire, the country's in ruins. Providence bleeds facing the sun. Where are the day is done. Until the day is done. So we've written our stories to entertain. These notions of glory and bull market gain. The teleprompt flutters, the power surge brings. An easy speaking message falls into routine.